I hope it isn't improper this morning for me to tell you that this is the happiest ministry I have ever had in my life. All my life, I have wanted to speak in a room just like this. But much of my life, I didn't know anything about the Congregationalists, and I had no real expectation of ever living in New England, so I never thought it would happen. It has, and I am more grateful than I can say to you for what you have done. One of the joys of any ministry is watching children grow up. And I thought this morning as I listened, while Christy Wiggins read so beautifully and with such poise, of the time about 4.5 years ago when she was the very first person, very first child, who ever read the scriptures in our church. Her name is on our very first bulletin. She was a little girl, now she's a young woman. That is a wonderful thing to witness. I think it would be naive, despite all the new translations and the constant sales, to suppose that very many people have a serious interest in studying the collection of books we call the Bible. This includes some very good people whose lives are exemplary. It may include some of you. Preachers in pulpits constantly exhort us to study the Bible. Some of us feel we would like to study it if the right chance ever came. And from time to time, a few of us even make brief excursions into it, decide to read it through from cover to cover, which is an unwise choice, before we bog down in Numbers and in the dreadfully dull book of Leviticus and mumble to ourselves, well, maybe some other time. I have great sympathy for these people because serious Bible study is not nearly so easy or simple as radio and television preachers would have us think. There are many reasons for that, but I restrict myself this morning to just one of them. The fact that about one-third of the Bible is written in the form of poetry, and that poetry has to be read in a special way. It cannot be read in the way one reads the newspaper or Time magazine, which are written in the everyday language we call prose. I'd like you to consider for a moment the difference between these two, between prose and poetry. Prose is the linguistic instrument we use most of the time. I'd like a cup of coffee, please. How much is that dress? Prose, in other words, is primarily the language of daily business, of factual information. If we need to explain how to fix a lawnmower or describe the world food shortage, we use prose. It is a flexible medium, and it does have ways of touching the emotions when that is desired, but primarily it tries to communicate facts. Poetry, on the other hand, is the language of emotion. Men and women write poetry when they want, above all else, to make us feel something. It's a kind of music made of words. It goes as straight as it can to our emotions. It has a discernible rhythm, like music. It makes melodious sounds, like music. And on top of that, it is full of images or pictures to appeal to our sense of sight and smell. Before we look at a biblical poem, we need always to remember another thing about poetry. It will usually be written in the grip of strong feeling, so that it tends to be the mirror of a moment rather than the pattern of a whole life. It springs from a mood, and its logic will not be conventional. If you try to read it so, if you are too literal-minded with it, you go awry. Now let's see how that may affect the way we read part of a biblical poem. I've chosen a couple of verses from the 55th Psalm, where some nameless poet has written in cadenced Hebrew that he is overwhelmed by all his troubles, that his heart is in anguish, and that the terrors of death itself have fallen heavily upon his spirit. He hits the bottom of bitterness and despair, and then he cries out, "Oh, that I had wings like a dove. I would fly away and be at rest. I would haste to find me a shelter from the raging storm." Those words represent the mood of a moment. In normal times, the man who wrote them probably faced up to frustration and defeat, but right now he'd like to run and hide, or set sail like a dove and fly off. This, at least, is what his heart tells him in its grief. But his mind knows better. He is a man, not a dove, and he cannot fly away. He can run and hide, but then he'll be remembered as a coward. So in his desperation, with no other option left, he sings out the only comfort he can think of at the moment: "Cast your burden upon the Lord, and he will sustain you. He will never permit the righteous to be moved." Or, as the Living Bible puts that last part, "He will not permit the godly to slip or fall." Do you believe that? I'm not asking, do you believe it partly, but do you believe in it wholly and literally, just as it stands? I don't. And I am in good company, because Jesus didn't either. He rejected the thought world of that old poem. Immunity, he said, is not given to the children of God. The rain falls on the just and the unjust alike, whether it's a curse or a blessing. Life is full of accident that has nothing to do with whether people are religious or not. A baby tumbles into a sump pump hole and drowns. An officer dies trying to keep the community free from illegal drugs. If we know how to read poetry, and the 55th Psalm is a poem, we have to know the difference between a hope expressed fervently and a promise of immunity from harm. Otherwise, our faith life never grows up. Sometimes we read so carelessly that we aren't even sure what it is exactly that the words on the page are saying. One of my favorite ministers of another time was amused one morning at a church where the Psalms were being chanted, and where just a seat or two away from him, a dear older woman was energetically singing these words from her book: "Whoso privily slandereth his neighbor, him will I destroy. Morning by morning will I destroy all the wicked of the land." Putting aside his doubt that she could define privy slander. My man said that she did not look at all that violent or dangerous, that she had only an umbrella, and that he doubted she meant to destroy the next person she came upon who was slandering his neighbor. The words are ultimately God's, of course, but she didn't expect God to do that either. Yet there she was, enthusiastically chanting words which meant next to nothing to her. We do not chant the Psalms here, except when we sing a hymn made of one, but we still manage to commit the sin of unreality once in a while. We stand up and sing, I have heard us do this, take my silver and my gold, not a mite would I withhold, when I have felt sure it might well endanger the life of an usher who tried to take our words at face value and collect. Or we run through the Lord's Prayer, as we did today, and we say that we wish to be forgiven as we have forgiven others, when there are people in our lives of whom we have said, I wouldn't forgive that man if he crawled all the way from Hutchinson on his knees. When words get so familiar that we no longer hear them, feel them, then there is no judgment against us, and there is no inspiration for us. Back now to that one verse we heard from the 55th Psalm. Cast your burden upon the Lord. I want to put that beside two other statements from the Bible so that we can have a demonstration of how truth is found. A verse in the Christian scripture says, bear one another's burdens. And a few lines further on, Paul has still another piece of advice. Every man shall bear his own burden. Now we've run the gamut. Put your burden on the Lord. Put your burden on your brother. Put your burden on yourself. Are they all equally true? Can one of them be pulled out because you like it and made into a dogma, an item of absolute faith on which a church is built? My answer would be that all of them contain truth, but no single one of them has all the truth about the bearing of burdens. We put them together, make some adjustments, remember that no single verse can express the whole of our experience, and we arrive at truth. Certainly most of us identify very well with that last verse. Every man shall bear his own burden. Or as Phillips puts it, every man must shoulder his own pack. The truth you get in that line is the essential loneliness of human life. It may seem busy and crowded most of the time, but there are moments when you are totally alone and when no other human being can enter in to what you feel. My profession often puts me in the company of people when they are living through such times. A man in the prime of life, strong and robust, with never a thought that he might not live out his full term, is suddenly struck by a terminal illness. He has known others with that bad luck. He has read of it often enough in the newspapers and clucked his tongue with pity. But in some queer way, he has always supposed that even if it came to others, it would not come to him. When it does, his friends call and send cards, and some who believe in prayer speak prayers for him. His family tries in every way they know to be close and supportive. But I have learned that what always happens at some point is this. There comes the moment when this man, who liked to stay up late, goes up early to bed because he is exhausted. And he looks at himself in the mirror while the sounds of other voices come up, of people who are planning their lives for years ahead, eating food and laughing as if appetite and joy could never fail them. And he looks in the mirror at his face and sees the truth and the terrible loneliness of his destiny falls upon him. Or he wakes in the morning before the day breaks and hears his children stir in the room next to him, or his wife's quiet breath in the same bed, and he realizes that another day of pain and weakness lies before him, and that not many even of those days are in his future. He faces, utterly by himself, the bitter knowledge that before long he will not lie in this bed or walk in this house, and that he will become a slowly receding memory to the people who know him. If he cannot accept that burden once and for all, then he has to accept it again every day, because it belongs to him. In certain essential ways, it cannot be shifted. This is a grief, said another Hebrew poet, Jeremiah. This is a grief, and I must bear it. This is the first immemorial truth of our existence. We bear our own burdens. But thank goodness, which is to say, thank God, that is only part of the truth. Not all of it. With any luck at all, we have at least one friend to whom we can tell our defeat or secret sorrow and win understanding. Some dear other person now shares part of that burden with us. Life is a solo. We've learned that part of the truth, and we can interpret that line of poetry from the Bible, every man shall bear his own burden. But life is also a chorus. You are to bear one another's burdens. And so we try, and in part we succeed, and another bit of truth and wisdom speaks to us from the pages of a book. And so we come by stages to the last facet of this truth, the one we started with in the psalm, that there is some way in which those who believe can cast their burden upon the Lord and be sustained. We dare not push it too far, or we pass beyond truth. I remember an old church hymn which said that God not only shares, but bears it all for us. I think the words are false. He does not bear it all. But there is some truth here, if only we don't try to make it say too much. Jesus understood the delicate balance and the ambiguities of language. When he invited people to come with their burdens, he said, "Take my yoke upon you, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light." But notice that even in that promise, there is still a yoke and still a burden. One has to go on pulling his own load in life's moment of ultimate loneliness. One has to shoulder at times the burden of someone else, but the promise is also that for those who do these things under the grace of devotion, it will be easier. So how is truth found, even in sacred scripture? Not by clutching one line to your heart and racing off with it to start your own church. That's what we've done already far too often. And so we have 350 churches, all of them claiming to have found the truth and to have it in their pockets. It is the congregational way to say that it is not that easy, that the Bible demands the keenest intelligence and the most honest flexibility you can bring to it, and that to turn any single statement into a rigid creed is to do an injustice to a noble book. We call you today and always to thoughtfulness. It is a beautiful word.